This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Civil disturbance and the changing face of Europe. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Riots in France are the latest evidence that the children of immigrants are angry about unemployment, inequality, and cultural isolation. As more and more Europeans stay away from Christian churches, observant Muslims are increasing in number. On To the Point, we'll look at what demographic changes could mean to the economies and the cultures of Europe. Will coping with poverty threaten the viability of welfare states? Will continued immigration and rapid birth rates transform national identities? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Walmart and its critics are fighting for the hearts, the minds, and even the souls of consumers. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Riots in France are the latest evidence that the children of immigrants are changing the face of Europe. On To the Point, what are the pressures on welfare states and national identities? On Reporter's Notebook, Walmart and its critics have a new battleground: America's churches. First, this news update. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice went to Amman, Jordan today, but she scheduled an unexpected return to Jerusalem in hopes of brokering a deal between Israel and the Palestinians. Harvey Morris reports from Jerusalem for the Financial Times. Harvey, good to have you with us. Ms. Rice says that she wants the benefits of Israeli withdrawal from Gaza to be fully felt by the Palestinians. What specifically does that mean?
Well, the talks so far have centered around opening up the crossing points between Gaza and both Israel and Egypt. And there have been various sticking points that have been very hard to resolve. The man in charge of all this has been James Wolfensohn, the former World Bank president, who's now the special envoy for the quartet. He's been doing all the groundwork, but the presence here of Condoleezza Rice is thought to be the one thing that might break the deadlock.
You mean then that she will be involved directly in the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
I'm not sure that will be the case. I think that the negotiations are pretty much down to a technical stage. I think it's her very presence that will force through a deal, if possible. And the fact that she's extended her visit to the Middle East as given some grounds for optimism during the course of the day.
I understand that part of these technical agreements have to do with European monitors of crossing points. Who would they be? How would they work?
Yes, that part of the deal seems pretty much wrapped up. The Israelis and the Palestinians have also already agreed that there should be a third-party presence on the border between Egypt and Gaza. That would probably amount to a force of about 50 European officials, probably policemen, whose job would be to monitor that the Palestinian customs and border officials were doing their job properly. That will go ahead definitely as long as an overall deal is reached.
Will they have the power to make arrests if they see smuggling or if they see people crossing the border that shouldn't be crossing?
Well, that's what the Israelis wanted, but the EU were very firm on saying that they wanted to have a monitoring role. In other words, if they see somebody going through the procedures at the Palestinian checkpoint that they feel aren't being properly enforced, then they can ask the Palestinians to do the procedures again. But they don't want to have any responsibility for arresting suspects.
Talking with Harvey Morris, the Financial Times correspondent in Jerusalem. So you said the presence of Secretary Rice might help to finalize these arrangements. What if it doesn't? What are the consequences for the quartet as well as the United States and its involvement in this area?
Well, I think if a deal isn't reached during her time here, it would be a very bad sign for Washington's involvement in the peace process. It would also mark quite a breakdown of the relationship between Israel and the U.S. because, after all, you know, she's putting her credibility on the line here to get a deal. So that's why I think probably something will be put together, probably tomorrow. If it is and it does go forward successfully, obviously that is a good sign for Washington's future engagement.
Why is this so important, especially for the Palestinians?
Well, I think the thing is there was a lot of optimism when Israel finally completed its withdrawal from Gaza, but it doesn't really mean much in practical terms to the Palestinians unless it leads to a reinvigoration of the economy, which is fairly impoverished at the moment. And that's what the quartet hoped for, and that's what Washington hoped for. And that's why everyone's rather upset to see the whole thing stalling since Israel pulled out in September.
You mentioned James Wolfensohn, formerly with the World Bank, now the special envoy for the quartet. He himself has a personal investment in the Palestinian economy.
Well, I think he's quite keen to not call it an investment. What he did was to put up some money along with a number of other American, predominantly American businessmen, I believe, to buy greenhouses in Gaza, which were previously owned by Jewish settlers and which have now been handed over to the Palestinian Authority.
So if then there were a failure of the harvest put into effect by the delay in opening the borders, would that have an impact?
Well, it certainly would. In the next few weeks, the crops from these greenhouses are supposed to be marketed, and if there isn't an adequate border regime out of Gaza, then these crops will pretty much rot in the greenhouses.
So the pressure is growing then, according to natural causes as well as politics.
Yeah, I mean, the greenhouses aren't really a very significant economic factor in Gaza, but there's a very big symbolic value to these crops coming out.
As there is, obviously, to the presence of Condoleezza Rice. We will, of course, watch closely for the outcome of this. And Harvey Morris, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, Financial Times correspondent in Jerusalem. In a moment, civil disturbance and the changing face of Europe on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Marvin Alney back with To the Point. In France, rioting continued for the 18th straight night, and today the cabinet of President Jacques Chirac asked Parliament to extend emergency rule for 3 months. A bit later, we'll hear how France is dealing with the angry children of immigrants. First to England, and another measure of change. Church-going Christians may soon be outnumbered by observant Muslims. Jonathan Peter is religion correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, one of London's more conservative dailies. Jonathan, thanks very much for joining us.
Not at all.
Tell us, if you will, what the studies are or what the evidence is for this change in religious observance in England.
Well, very recently a report was brought out by a statistician who studies these matters, Peter Brearley, and he looked at current trends and extrapolated them into the future. And he worked out that on those, there will be just 2% of the population attending Sunday services by 2040. And in contrast to that, there'll be nearly twice as Muslims at prayer in mosques as Christians worshipping on Sunday. His figures, I have to add, have been disputed by people in the mainstream churches who say they are too pessimistic, and they are working hard, obviously, to keep church going, steadying and not declining as fast as his figures would suggest. But nevertheless, there's a good deal of alarm at his findings.
What's the nature of the alarm? And beyond trying to get more people to go to church, what are people saying about it?
Well, Lord Carey, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury before Dr. Rowan Williams, the current Archbishop, he made a speech recently which was very pessimistic and had a very bleak assessment of the future of Christianity. And he said that Britain's churches are in such serious decline that if they were shops, they would have been declared bankrupt long ago. He said, though, there was always hope because the census figures for 2001 showed that 72% of the population still describe themselves as Christians. They just don't seem to be going to church. So there is hope among Christians that that can be turned around and that these people can be brought back to church.
What if they... excuse me, go ahead.
On the other hand, there is considerable pessimism that the decline is pretty inexorable now, and it's mirrored across Europe.
What are the consequences of that?
Well, it's be a fascinating to watch the change in British culture. It doesn't perhaps need to be as devastating as it sounds, because Muslim communities are still concentrated in relatively small areas of the country. The big concentrations, particularly up in the north of England and London conurbations, so that they're not going to dominate British culture in a geographical sense, but it could well be that they will represent the most religious element in this country before the end of the century.
You talk about optimism and pessimism. What would be wrong with that?
Well, I think a lot of people in this country are very secular. They're very tolerant to people having religious beliefs. But frankly, if Christianity did start to disappear, they are equally not very worried about that. And if Muslims make up the largest faith groups, then most people would accept that in modern Britain. It's a very tolerant place. Despite, obviously, some racial tensions, I don't think it's something that concerns politicians particularly or most people.
Why then be pessimistic about it?
Well, the churches obviously are pessimistic because they believe that the Christian message is their raison d'etre, and if they can't persuade the majority of people in what is nominally a Christian country, then that's the case, then obviously they're not doing their job very successfully. There are also people who believe that Christianity is tied up with the whole culture of the country, and that a diminution of Christianity will have a detrimental effect.
Jonathan Peter, again, religion correspondent for the Daily Telegraph in London. Salma Yaqub is vice chair of Respect. That's a new national left-leaning party in England. She lives in Birmingham. Ms. Yaqub, welcome back to our program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
What do you think about the consequences of this statistical analysis? I guess the first question I should have asked you actually is, do you agree with it?
Well, actually, no. I think... it's always difficult when you're trying to project that far into the future, and there's so many different conflicting trends right now. Yes, on the one hand, there seems to be a rise in secularism. On the other hand, we're also seeing a more worrying trend in some regards of religious fundamentalism across the globe. And we have Tony Blair, a committed Christian. We have George Bush, a committed Christian. And we've already seen the kind of consequences of their ideologies and their political stances, which are very much linked to their religious stance. And as far as the idea that somehow Islam is going to overtake Christianity in Britain, I really think that is taking things a bit too far, and I don't see that happening. And I speak as a British Muslim living in Birmingham, one of those conurbations that your first speaker referred to, where we actually do have higher percentage of Muslims than in other areas.
Would you or would most Muslims in Britain want to become the dominant religion?
Well, to be honest, no. I think it also depends on what as with all religions, we've got different kind of sects and different kinds of practices. I think what's more important is looking at our shared values, the common ground that people have, humanitarian values, and at the same time allowing people the individual practices and allowing that space, that diversity. And I think that's what is healthy about Britain in comparison to many other countries. There is that leeway, and I think that's a positive thing. It goes beyond just tolerance. It's about acceptance and genuine respect for diversity. And let's not forget, the latest census does say 73% of people still identify themselves as Christian, and we have 2.7% of people identify themselves as Muslims. So the idea that somehow just because Muslims may adhere to their beliefs slightly more strictly than Christians still would not lead, I think, to any kind of cultural or social threat. And quite honestly, even if there is a rise in Muslim practice, for myself, speaking as a British Muslim, I don't see a tension between being British and Muslim. I see a real interesting negotiating of identities and something that we're all adding to culture. Culture is not static. And we see the example of America, where it's in a country built on immigrants. I don't think its culture is any less for that.
Again, Selma Yacoob is vice chair for Respect, a left-leaning political party in Britain. Back to Jonathan Peter of the Daily Telegraph. You mentioned that many people think there is a connection between British culture and Christianity. Certainly, historically, that would be true. How much would British culture change, do you think, or how much will it change? Perhaps this is an ongoing process we're talking about here, as the presence of more and more Muslims comes to impact it.
Well, there are already signs of change, and they tend to be negative in the sense that they tend to be encouraging possibly the growth of secularism in certain areas. For example, councils will be very sensitive to Muslims, and there have been various cases where one council recently renamed its Christmas decorations winter lights rather than Christmas lights because they thought it might be offensive to Muslims. There's very little evidence that many Muslims were offended. But I think there will be a diminution of some of the long traditions, institutions, and it may also have an impact in the long term on the role of the monarchy, which has quite a strong Christian basis. But these are all very long-term trends.
Hasn't Prince Charles already said that he would like to be the leader, not of the faith, as has always been the term in England, but of the faiths, plural?
That's right. He has suggested that. It's one of those issues which is quite sensitive because some Christians feel that that would be selling out his birthright, and that because he becomes supreme governor of the Church of England, if he becomes monarch, then he should retain the title of Defender of the Faith. And many Muslims would accept that because they recognize that it's best to have a strong established religion, albeit Christianity, because that means that religion per se remains at the heart of the country. If the Christian faith slipped in its position in the country, then all faiths might suffer and be marginalized in official life, in political life, and in the life of the country.
So, Selma Yacoob, would you agree with that? Would it be acceptable to most of the Muslims in Britain if there were a defender, namely Prince Charles, or if he were to become King Charles, of the faiths, plural?
Yes, I don't think it's something that's really tearing the community apart in their discussions, whether he's defender of the faith or faiths. Obviously, it's a positive gesture to other communities, and it's not just something to do with pandering to the Muslim community when he's referred to as possibly becoming defender of the faith. It's in recognition of many different religions. We have Jews, atheists, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, all sorts of people of faith and no faith in England. I think Johnson made an interesting point about would Muslims prefer to live in an established church country, because it may mean there's more religious tolerance and acceptance. And he may well have a point there. On the other hand, there's different kinds of secularisms. Now, when you have a fundamentalist secular state, then, of course, any person of any religion is more likely to feel are not comfortable. But then again, if you have a religious state, but which is fairly secular in its approach, then it gives that room and breathing space for all backgrounds. And I think the important thing is, whatever overall label it is, the reality, the experience of people in that country, as long as it's about freedom of choice, being able to live and let live, that to me is far more important than a label of secular or religious. Because we've seen across the world different societies where they may take on a religious veneer but end up being very oppressive. By the same token, in countries like France, I would venture, where in theory you have every citizen is equal, it's a secular state, but actually I think it's quite an extreme state in their approach to their citizens, especially with people of different backgrounds.
Salma Yacoub, again, Vice Chair for Respect, talked to us by cell phone from Birmingham, England, and Jonathan Peter, religion correspondent for the Daily Telegraph in London. You've both mentioned France. Let me turn to Mark Levine, who has recently returned from France. He's an assistant professor of modern Middle Eastern history and culture and Islamic studies at the University of California at Irvine, also author of a new book called Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. Professor Levine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's open with what we just heard from Salma Yacoub, that France, she said, by comparison to Britain, is rather extreme in this question of nationalism, with even though it's a secular country, the religious aspect. What would you say about the differences between the way those two countries are coping with the enormous increase of Muslims?
Well, I think the most important thing is to understand how we're defining religion. When we define religion just in terms of how faithful people are to their belief tradition, then we can talk about the narrowing of British faith will somehow mean an explosion of Muslim faith because there are more faithful Muslims than there are Christians in Britain. And in France, one could say a similar thing. But religion is much more than just what you believe. It's a larger cultural milieu in which you exist. And in that sense, for example, in Britain, there's no chance anytime in the near future that Islam or Muslim culture is going to be the dominant culture. But in France, it's a situation where the official culture is militantly, as Salma said, secular. And it's militantly secular to the point where you can almost talk about it as a religion. The theologian Paul Tillich once said, religion is whatever is of ultimate concern to a person. And in that sense, France is actually a very religious country in the way it treats its secularism. And for Muslims, the secularism of France is also tied to a history of French colonialism in their cultures, a history of institutionalized racism and discrimination against them that has gotten so bad over the last decades, precisely at the point when France is trying to continue to define itself as a secular culture where anyone who wants to be seen as French has to basically, at the public sphere, put aside their religious and any other cultural beliefs. And that's really the struggle that's going on now between culture, between politics, and between very real material economic goods for which there's not enough to disperse both to French Muslims, quote unquote, and to what's known as the vrai français, the real French, who are only a few euros short of turning to Le Pen.
Le Pen being?
Jean-Marie Le Pen is the head of the National Front, the extreme right-wing party in France, which made it into the runoff in the last elections.
So, in other words, then, there are real cultural and political consequences to what we're seeing in France, and we're going to talk about those further after we take a very brief break for station identification. We'll come back in a moment, as I indicated, a little later on Reporter's Notebook. The battleground for Walmart and its critics has shifted to America's churches. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Mormon Ali back with To The Point, talking today about the growth of the Muslim population in Europe. We've just been talking about Britain and what it could mean there in terms of religion, culture, and economics. We've now shifted to France. We're talking with Mark Levine, Assistant Professor of Modern Middle Eastern History, Culture, and Islamic Studies at the University of California at Irvine. A couple of issues here, economics and religion, obviously very much entwined in this situation. Certainly, though, this 18 days or nights of rioting that we have seen, I should add, too, that France has the part of the cabinet today has asked Parliament for the extension of the emergency order for another 3 months. That appears to be more about economics than religion, does it not? Or am I wrong?
Well, in fact, you see, the problem is not Islam in France. The problem is that so many of the people who have been ghettoized are Muslims. They're either black Africans, most of whom are Muslim, or they're North Africans who are almost entirely Muslim. And they, because they are Muslim, because they come from former colonies, they have been ghettoized. They do not receive their fair share of government spending, even though there is this, a quote-unquote, bloated French welfare state. It's certainly not bloated in the banlieue, in the ghettos. And so religion, when you have the French government that is traditionally ignored or marginalized them, you have the French right, which really vehemently dislikes them, you have the French left, which completely ignores them and is still also in many ways racist against the immigrants. The only groups left are really the religious groups. The surprising thing about these riots, however, is how little it seems that the extreme religious Muslim groups have been able to penetrate into these young Muslim communities. These kids are Muslim culturally, but they have not yet in any way become, the majority of them, Muslim in a religious way, and certainly not in a negative way. So there's still hope in that sense. But in order to do something, you're really going to have to see a fundamental change in what makes France French. You're going to have to see, in some ways, a new republic, a sixth republic, that is no longer defined by a militant secularism and defines a new way for Muslims to be able to become integrated economically and socially and culturally and politically. This is really the test for the coming years.
Mark Levine, again, assistant professor of at the University of California at Irvine, member of France's National Assembly, part of President Chirac's governing party, joins us now. Among the areas he represents is Yvelines, the suburb southwest of Paris, where there has been rioting over the past almost 3 weeks now. Jacques Millard, welcome back to our program. Good to have you.
Well, it's good to hear you as well.
Comment, if you will, on what we just heard from Mark Levine, who says there's a great challenge now.
I think what he said, I'm sorry to say, is a nonsense, because those riotings have nothing to do with religion. It is a question of social unhappiness, this is true. It's also a question, let's say, of lack of order, lack of authority in the suburbs for the past 25 years. But if you say you are speaking of Muslim, you know, even those who are coming from Africa and so on, they are not all Muslims, or at least they don't want to, let's say, they don't face France, French problems that they see as religious problems. So it's a big mistake to confuse immigrants with religions. Of course, some would like to pray in France. They can do that. They can have mosques, and they have mosques. And secondly, the question that we are facing with the youth, it's at the most, if in the Paris suburbs, if there are 2,500 of those kids who are vandals and who are rioting, that's the most. You know, that small unit, they are dealing in a guerrilla basis, but the large amount of those populations do want to integrate and integrate, even if there is a higher rate of unemployment in those suburbs. It doesn't mean that for those who are looking for a job, they can't find any. And when I have heard that the racism, there is a French racism against those population, let me laugh. Because, you know, in many civil service, in many enterprise, we do integrate those people. We do have them as civil servants. And it's an insult to many, many Frenchmen to speak this way. I think this confuses things. We have a social problem. It is true that culturally, sometimes it's more difficult to integrate people, especially coming from Black Africa, because those who were the most violent are coming from Black Africa and are not Muslim, because they are the son of dismantled families, polygamic families. in which they are just lost, you know. So it has nothing to do with religion, and it is a big mistake to pretend that it is a Muslim question.
All right. What about the professor's statement that in order to thoroughly integrate and the people that we are talking about, largely the children of immigrants, it's going to be necessary to change what it means to be French?
Well, I'm sorry to say that the other way, which is so-called multicultural society, is also in a failure when you look what has happened in Britain, where they got even bombing. So you could see that we are one-to-one in the question of integration. We have a problem with integration of those people, but mainly because there is a cultural gap between their habits and what we ask for any citizens in France or in Britain. So I think that, in fact, the point is that we have been 2 weeks in terms of authority, you know, because step by step, the lack of authority has built up very genuine parallel society in which sometimes those kids, those writers, have been trying to impose their law. And in fact, writing has begun when the police have started to dismantle their own subterranean economy, their own business. You know, you should not forget that. It doesn't mean, of course, that we should not improve our way to integrate them. But there is no chance that France become a multicultural policy state, because we are living in a secular state. And I think this is a good approach. But of course, we should, first of all, stop illegal immigration, because, of course, we have, let's say, a certain amount of those people. We should integrate them. We should work on that. But we cannot, let's say, admit all the poverty of the world, you see. So we should stop illegal immigration. Secondly, for those who are writing and are foreigners, they have to be sent back. Thirdly, for those who want to live in here peacefully, of course, we should help them to integrate and maybe one day to become French if they are not. But for young kids who have been writing, we have to be very firm. We have to re-educate them with special units, you know, on a small size to really to teach them discipline, to teach them a job,
okay,
and to be firm.
All right. Again, Jacques Maillard, a member of the National Assembly from President Chirac's governing party. Also with us today is Faisal Devji, who is professor of history at the New School University in New York. He's also author of Landscapes of the Jihad, Militancy, Morality, and Modernity. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Very interested in your take on what we just heard from Jacques Maillard. No multiculturalism in France, he says. Return illegal immigrants who are in France now. Try to integrate those who want to be integrated and establish order. Is that a recipe for success?
Well, one can't say. All I can say is that this kind of rhetoric has been in place for a number of decades now and doesn't seem to have really helped much. In fact, it seems to have led to this rather critical situation that France finds itself in. I do agree with him, however, that it's not a question of asking France to completely reject its traditional political culture. I don't think that is the issue. But that these solutions are not really solutions. In other words, how long can one, as it were, keep immigrant populations out? Does the banning of illegal immigrants, forget about illegal immigration, how about immigration altogether, will that actually resolve anything? Are we not dealing with large populations already settled in France? And also it doesn't get to the fact that the riots that we have seen in France have actually followed a peculiarly French and not, in fact, a foreign pattern, which is, say, this is part of the Republican tradition in France, to go out on the streets, manifestations, you know, demonstrations, etc. This is something that is a French fact. It's a fact of French history. The last severe ones happened in 1968, and that is, of course, the comparison that is always made with the current set of riots, even though the participants are very different in both cases. So one can't actually accuse the riots of coming out of some other country, some place outside France. They are a part of French political culture, and they are an integral part of it, and they need to be dealt with in terms of the political culture.
What about what we heard earlier from Professor Levine, that France has a problem now because of the social programs that it is proposing to extend to people who haven't been the beneficiaries before? Will that mean taking them away, taking benefits away from people who are used to them? What about Jean-Marie Le Pen?
Yes, well, the thing about benefits and social programs is that in the way we heard the gentleman from the National Assembly speak, some of it sounded like, a political speak from the ex-Soviet Union of re-education in small units with firmness and discipline. It sounds rather scary. But even if it were not scary, it betrays that the language of politics that those comments came from is in fact completely dated. It belongs to the Cold War. It's a language of re-education. It's not something that one expects to see preferred as a kind of solution to what appears to be a new problem. So that, I think, is a major issue, whether it's Le Pen or anyone else who's promulgating these kinds of acts. But I would also like to say, if I may, that as far as Professor Levine's identification of race and religion, the interesting thing for me about these riots is that in these places, which not so long ago, protest movements were phrased religiously, for instance, over the veil, the issue of the of unveiling female Muslim students, at this point they have become racialized. They've gone back to what seems to be an older language of race and integration. And that's very interesting. What it seems to me to demonstrate is that those categories are in fact relatively unstable and ungrounded, that you can actually move from a language of religious protest or religious politics to a one of race and vice versa. There's something, in other words, there's no one-size-fits-all solution because the categories themselves are up in the air and are incredibly amorphous.
Faisal Devji, again, professor of history at New School University in New York. I want to go back again to Jacques Maillard, our National Assembly member from the governing party in France. It's just been said that the riots, as we have seen them in France, are traditional and being carried out in a way that's very familiar there. It's also been pointed out that at the moment, at least, there does not seem to be an extreme religious element to the writing. How do you account for those things?
Well, as I told you, I think that the movement that we have experienced is not at all religion-based. I think that it has been, a slowing descent of authority in the suburbs. Because I will tell you,
you've said that before, but isn't it also a sense of isolation and anger because the benefits of French citizenship haven't been extended to the children of immigrants?
No. You should really understand what is at stake. It is in each suburb, maybe up to 100 kids who are writing. And it's very narrow, concentrated, sometimes a circle of 200 meters, sometimes 500. So you should not confuse things. Those are a small minority. And I said if there are at most in the Paris suburbs 2,500, that's the most. Give me 50 men and I put Paris ablaze, 50 determined men and I burn Paris very quickly. We are living in a free society. The point was that the response of the society towards those violent guys did not exist until now. And I give you an example. In a few years ago in Strasbourg, in Alsace, where you have the European Parliament, they were each eve, on the 31st of December, 300, 400 cars burned until the time of the socialist government. No one, you hear me? No one was suited in front of the tribunal. So those had felt that they are immune, that they cannot be touched, So the point is that today we say stop. Now there is a stop. And I tell you one, if it is not the state which does it, it will be the population of the suburbs who will do it because they are fed up with those caïds and they will take arms and restore law and order by themselves.
Jacques Maillard, once again with President Chirac's the governing party, a member of the National Assembly. Thanks very much for joining us. Back to Faisal Devji, at New York University, New School, rather. Your comment on what we just heard.
He repeats his point, which has a certain validity, which is, I think he's right, although perhaps excessive, in saying that France needs to deal with these issues with her, you know, through her own political traditions. That is all, that is certainly true. But whether or not the firm hand is all that it takes, I don't know. In other words, while I think it's perfectly true that people engaged in criminal activity should be dealt with in according to the laws of the land, that's not in dispute at all, there has to be a recognition of a general failure. Now, whether this failure is one of not extending religious or social, in fact, rights, that's a question. Also, one has to consider that the whole the old-fashioned French welfare state is in a period of transition for everyone. Whether this hurts people who are non-white or are in fact Muslim by default, one also needs to take into consideration. But that this is not—it's not a question, as so many on the left would have it, of somehow just preserving the welfare state or simply extending the welfare state, because that welfare state is in a period of transition all over Europe. It's not going to survive in the way that it has been brought into being. And that, I think, we need to be realistic about this. We need to find, or rather they need to find, new ways of addressing these issues, which is not simply about a leftism that is actually conservatism, because it is about simply preserving what already exists and expanding it. And that puts the left in a really odd position.
Again, Faisal Devji, professor of history at the New School University in New York. Excuse me for getting you in the wrong institution a moment ago. Let me go back to Mark Levine, our assistant professor at the University of California at Irvine. It sounds like a kind of perfect storm here in Europe. How can Europeans avoid this confusion of the kind of transition that we've heard talked about from the welfare state to something less beneficent than we've seen in the past without its being confused with these religious issues, given the nature of the immigrants and their children, the new population?
Well, I think the first thing we need to hope doesn't happen is that people follow the kind of rhetoric that we just heard from Mr. Maillard, because in fact, he tried to take economic issues and turn it into cultural ones. We need to discipline unruly youth and help them integrate more into French culture. The whole problem is that the French government and the French state and the French Republic has not done that over the years. And in fact, it is an economic problem because services to help improve the lives of these people have been cut by over 20% just in the last few years. So this is about money. And it is about also who is not getting the money is very much determined by what their racial or ethnic or religious background is. So we can't separate these things. But this is why, I mean, France, like all countries in Europe, and this is what the no vote in, I was there for that also, against the European Constitution in late May was about too. What is Europe? What is France going to be in an era where, because of globalization and the kind of globalization that's occurring, the welfare state that is taking care of so many of the white Europeans, which is exactly the kind of services that quite naturally the other inhabitants, the other citizens of these countries would like to have, what's going to happen when no one can have these kind of services? And when you're getting, as long as the governments and the countries are refusing to acknowledge the race issues or issues of discrimination based on race or religion or ethnicity, then you're going to have a zero-sum competition for limited and increasingly limited funds. And this is what I mean by people have to think, how do we want to use increasingly limited government funds? Do we want to disperse it equally to everyone, or is it going to be a fight over these funds in which race, as the professor mentioned, I think it's not surprising that religion gets transmuted into race, because race is a much more core issue, and it's much easier in France, which has unfortunately a tradition of racism, like most countries, to play that card and to keep people discriminated and to talk only about authority and law and order and give me 50 men and I can do this or I could have arrested them. This can't work because, in fact, the prisons are the best recruitment centers for the criminal elements and the jihadi elements. So if you take all these young people, throw them in prison for a year or two, they may not be radicals now in a religious sense, but there's a good chance they're going to come out as well-trained criminals or religious radicals. So this has to be a real national discussion, which most people, including the left, has failed to have so far.
Very quickly, Salma Yaqub is still with us, and she's with Respect, the left-leaning political party in Britain. We really don't have any time left, but I know you've been with us. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to comment on what we've just heard from both of our guests about what's liable to happen to the welfare state, regardless of the religious and racial issues all involved here.
Yeah, I think Mark's touched on some very salient points. Let's not look at this just as a European problem. You've just had Hurricane Katrina in America, and some of the racial divisions and inequalities were very much exposed. And what we're seeing in Europe today is very much an echo of what we saw in 1967, for example, in the Detroit riots. But it wasn't just a religious issue. It was about black people feeling disenfranchised. These riots are not about people revolting against the state. It's not about them saying we don't want to be integrated. In fact, they're saying we want a greater part, a greater stake in French society, just as the black people were saying we want a greater part and a greater stake in American society. So whilst it's very worrying, hopefully the lessons should be learned. And following the Detroit and New York riots, we saw that there was a move towards more equality. And that fight, in a way, is still going on. As you can see, it's not quite won even to this day. And the French Republic does have to look at what's gone wrong, and just using bland terms like, oh, we need more authority, it is not going to solve the problem. And the fact that he claims that we've got people of different races in every civil level of society, he cannot even substantiate that, because it's virtually illegal in France today to even monitor ethnicity. So I think that has been part of the problem. They cannot even track how well or how poorly people are integrated. So we need a multicultural model, and something I think Britain actually has got a very positive one. And just one final point.
Very quickly,
yes,
if you will.
7-7, but the issue of 7-7 was not about integration. In fact, those bombers spoke English well. They were very much part of society. It was a political action. And if it had not been for the war in Iraq, such a thing would not have happened. That was, let's not confuse multiculturalism and political and religious extremism. They are two separate issues.
All right. 7-7, July 7th, the four bombings in the transit system of London. Thank you all. We're just scratching the surface, of course, of an enormously complex issue. We'll come back to it again and again. Hopefully with some of our same guests, Salma Yaqub, Vice Chair of Respect in Britain, Mark Levine, Assistant Professor, University of California at Irvine, Fazel Devji, Professor of History, New School, University in New York, also Jacques Millard of the French National Assembly, and Jonathan Peter of the Daily Telegraph in London. Thanks again to all of you for being with us. Walmart is fighting a high-stakes battle with liberal critics, including unions, which have not been able to organize the world's biggest retailer. Now, from advertising, media outreach, and public debate, the struggle has shifted to a new arena, America's churches. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Walmart and its critics have been fighting each other for hearts and minds. Now they've turned to a battle for souls. That's according to today's Los Angeles Times in a story by Abigail Goldman. Abigail, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Warren.
Let's look first at Walmart. Which churches is Walmart going into, and what's the message?
Well, it's a little unclear. Walmart will not comment about these efforts. Instead, we talked to ministers who had been contacted by Walmart, who had met with representatives from Walmart. And those ministers included members of various different faiths. I spoke to Baptists. I spoke to Christian Methodists. I spoke to a variety of different people, and they all talked about various groups of ministers meeting with Walmart representatives who wanted to explain why Walmart was good for communities.
Why is Walmart good for communities, and what's the religious connection?
Well, Walmart has been involved with churches in the past. They distribute money. Their philanthropic giving is largely store-based, and they have in the past given money to church projects. They don't give money to churches, but if a church project is one that benefits a wider community, Walmart will consider funding that as part of those small grants. So Walmart has been involved with churches before. Walmart Watch and some of the anti-Walmart groups have increasingly been involved with the faith community in their efforts to mobilize people against the retailer. So I think we're seeing it on both sides.
Walmart Watch, is that primarily an organization financed by the unions that are trying to organize Walmart?
There are two different big groups that are working against Walmart. One is Walmart Watch, which has been involved in this particular action. That has union involvement. Certainly Andrew Stern, the president of the Service Employees International Union, sits on their board. But so does the president, the executive director of the Sierra Club, professor, and various others. The other group that you may have heard about is Wake Up Walmart, and that is actually funded and put together by a union group.
Now, is Wake Up Walmart also going into the churches or just Walmart Watch?
They work together on some things. Walmart Watch is the one that is sponsoring screenings of a movie that is an anti-Walmart movie in churches and discussions as part of what it's calling its Higher Expectations Week. That's a week-long series of screenings of this movie and various other activities designed to galvanize people against the retailer.
Are they going into the same churches that the Walmart people are meeting with, or are there different religious communities here?
It's a little bit of overlap and a little bit of the same. Some of the people I spoke to, some of the ministers I spoke to, are people who are planning to screen this film. It's unclear whether Walmart knew that when it reached out to some of these same pastors, but there is overlap, definitely.
So what appears to be the significance here? Why the churches? And what brought both sides to be making these kinds of appeals to these particular people?
It is a different group. Certainly for the anti-Walmart folks, the faith-based community can be a way to reach new and different people who would not necessarily be sympathetic. It also, in the case of some churches, is a very sympathetic group. Certain churches that have long been involved in justice and wage equity type of issues. For Walmart, it is some of their base would definitely be people of faith and church-going people who would likely be Walmart supporters. But Walmart is also reaching out beyond its sort of comfort level to reach people who are in those same churches that would traditionally be more sympathetic to the labor side of the issue. It's a chance, I think, for both sides to reach into the other's backyard to see who they can influence and see who they can convince to come over to their respective sides.
The world's biggest retailer, enormous amount at stake in communities and everywhere, and the church is now getting involved. Abigail Goldman with the Los Angeles Times, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Warren. My pleasure.
Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Sherman Rembaum and Francis Anderton, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.